Now to start with, I'm one of those old-fashioned, outdated people who still think like, say, Schiller at the end of the 18th century and believe that art, or at least literature and film, somehow aims at the beautiful, the good, and the true. And to come back to the topic of the conference, to aim at the beautiful, the good, and the true involves many ways of establishing relations between the actual and the possible, the present and the latent. By aiming at the true, I mean trying to uncover how things are and how things work, in contrast to what is falsely believed to be the case. By aiming at the good, I mean to question the actual ways of life, and the current conventional morals, and to discover alternative possibilities which are hidden within the actual and so could be called latent. The beautiful I understand in a very traditional Kantian sense, that is not as prettiness or anything of this sort, but as a free interplay between imagination and understanding. Now to come to the searchers, I think that this movie is quite exemplary with regard to what I, for lack of a better term, call aesthetic understanding. I'm not very happy with this term, but I haven't found a better one. Aesthetic understanding is different from the kind of understanding which results, say, from reading a sociological or historical treatise, in as far as it is not fulfilled by explanation. That is, it can contain many explanations, it's somehow a search for explanation, but it does not end with discovering explanation, that is, relations between cause and effect, motive and action within a narrative. Aesthetic understanding develops the awareness of a problem or a topic, but it does not result in intellectual certainties which could be expressed in a set of assertions. Those of you who know Kant will recognize this conception. Aesthetic understanding is based on the free interplay of imagination and understanding, which Kant called the beautiful. And this interplay, now I'm leaving Kant behind, is not triggered by knowledge of facts or events within the narrative, but I think by a sense of importance, which somehow presents a riddle. For example, the spectator of a movie is shown something, the explanation of which is hidden, for example, a close-up, which shows a certain expression often on a face one does not really know to interpret. An example is this. This is an expression of the character who is played by John Wayne. In a certain situation where he has looked at some young white women who were liberated from a Comanche camp, who had been kidnapped before and lived with the Comanche, and who seemed to be maltreated and kind of psychically unstable. And he looks like this, and you don't know what that means, but you start thinking, what conclusion does he draw from that? How does this situation affect the way he thinks, etc.? aesthetic understanding starts with a sense of importance, but with a sense of importance you don't know to interpret yet. And it forces the mind, the sense of imagination triggers the mind to wonder and search for explanation, both on a conscious and on a subconscious level. The elements of aesthetic reasoning I have put here, as it starts with a sense of importance. I take this for provided. The importance is not argued, like in a philosophical treatise. sondern it is established by pointing to something, like a close-up. One points to a face, one points to an expression, and not explaining it. The lack of explanation triggers the interplay between imagination and reasoning to wonder and search for connections and analogies. One can't stop with this. One somehow has to know about it. One becomes unquiet. And this is a process, not a result. You may come when you wander around and think about connections and explanations. You may come to a lot of insight, and but aesthetic understanding is never exhausted by conclusions. Now, when you look at this theme song from the Searchers, insert understanding or knowledge for home, you see that what is a theme song of a typical Western is quite similar to what I called aesthetic understanding. What makes a man to wander, what makes a man to roam, what makes a man leave bed and board and turn his back on home right away, etc. This is a typical motive on a Western, the lonely rider who appears and who rides again, who somehow searches for home, but who will never find a home. And I think the same is true of aesthetic understanding. I'm not suggesting that Ford, when he chose this theme song, had in mind to reflect on aesthetics as well, but the way he employs aesthetic understanding is really very similar to this motive. Now I begin with the plot, or what the movie presents as fact. The movie The Searchers, of course, is too complex to tell in all details, especially with regard to the symbolism of the pictures. You know that it plays a lot with the contrast of inside a house and outside, the contrast of settled family life and nomadism. And I guess most of you know it rather well, but still maybe not all, and I will repeat some essentials of the plot to help you remember. The narrative of The Searchers starts with the arrival of Ethan, played by John Wayne, a lonely rider with a rather dubious past at the settlement of his brother Aaron, his wife Martha, and their children. A short time afterwards, while Ethan and Marty, the adopted son of the family, are absent, the family is massacred by a group of Comanches led by the war chief Sharks Carr, who kidnap the two daughters. While the older girl, Lucy, is soon found killed, Ethan and Marty start to search for Debbie, the 9-year-old one. During the search, Ethan shows himself both a protective and a very nasty and destructive person. He often attempts to prevent people from seeing things that might hurt them, but at the same time he behaves himself quite hurtful and cruel. He shoots people in the back, he mutilates the dead body of a native and shoots buffaloes to deprive the natives of their food. When he explains his actions, he exhibits both a quite extraordinary and unexplained knowledge of Indian culture and at the same time an obsessive hatred of Indians. Now the search takes years, during which Ethan and Marty once and again come back to visit the neighbor family Jorgensen. They undergo several adventures, including a somehow accidental marriage of Marty with a Comanche woman, who later is killed by the army who massacres women and children in a Comanche village. Meanwhile, Marty realizes that Ethan, who harbors an intense hatred of Indians, no longer wants to bring the girl home, but to kill her. When they finally find Debbie, who by now is one of the wives of her kidnapper's car and considers the Comanche her people, Ethan tries to shoot her, but fails, because he at the same time is attacked by the Comanche. After having escaped, they come back with the army and the Texas Rangers to raid the Comanche village. Marty succeeds in persuading the colonel to let him sneak in before the attack in order to save Debbie. Then he finds Debbie and somehow accidentally shoots Carl. While the Rangers charge through the camp, Ethan rides his horse into his car's tent, knocking over a woman carrying a baby, and the next shot shows him emerging from the tent's car's bloody scalp in his hand and a perplexed look on his face. This is also one of the close-ups which leave you with a sense of importance, but you cannot tell what that look means. Knocking down Marty, who tries to stop him, he rides after the fleeing Debbie and finally corners her in a cave. But then, in a totally unexpected and unexplained change of mind, instead of killing her, he takes her into his arms and raises her aloft in a gesture resembling the way he used to raise a little girl above his head. He says, "Let's go home, Debbie." Now, this is a case of latency, which appears like a true miracle, but still somehow makes sense. In retrospect, one could say that this possibility that he will not kill her, but save her, must have been always there. But considering the kind of man Ethan presented himself and that he had already attempted to murder Debbie, it was not to be expected. The last famous scene concerns the arrival at the ranch of their neighbors Jorgensen. While Mrs. Jorgensen takes Debbie inside, and Marty enters the house with his future wife Lori, the daughter of the Jorgensens, Ethan stands at the door, then turns and walks straight into the desert. The door closes upon him. That is a well-known last scene where he puts his left arm on the right one, and this is a scene where he raises Debbie, who still looks very afraid. Now I want to pose a question: how the movie deals with the topic of racism, which in the movie is related to the guise of the attitudes towards miscegenation, Rassenmischung. Obviously, the theme of miscegenation is omnipresent in the movie. It concerns not only Debbie. Marty is introduced as partly Cherokee, and Scar has blue eyes, which suggests that he had a white mother. The theme of a white woman who marries an Indian goes back to the 17th century and is prominent in the novels of James Fenimore Cooper. Thus, the subject of miscegenation was prominent in the sexual imagination of the white population. Still, miscegenation by means of abduction was a historical fact. The Comanche tribes had much increased during the late 17th century by adopting a policy of abducting children by raiding the villages of other natives, as well as white settlements. Some of the children were then ransomed, others remained with their captors. There also was some voluntary miscegenation between natives and white settlers, the most well-known by Sam Houston, founder of the state of Texas, who spent years with a Cheyenne and also married a Cheyenne. As a politician, he always took a stand for the rights of the native population. Still, in the context of an ongoing clash of cultures between the more belligerent tribes, like the Comanche and the settlers, miscegenation between natives and settlers was considered by many a shame and a disgrace. Thus, the Ford movie is rooted in historical fact as well as historical imagination. It was based on a novel by Ellen LeMay, which goes back to a true event namely the kidnapping of Cynthia Ann Parker, a 9-year-old girl in 1836, when a group of Comanche raided a settlement in eastern Texas, slaughtered her father, grandfather, and uncle, and kidnapped her and 5 other young people. Cynthia was then raised by her captors and became the wife of a Comanche warrior and mother of 3 children. James Parker, her uncle, a man of ambitious reputation and an intense hatred for Indians, searched 8 years for her and her fellow captives, recovered some of the missing, but not his niece, who lived with the Comanche for 20 years. In 1960, she was recaptured when the, in 1860, she was recaptured when the U.S. Cavalry and Texas Rangers massacred all inhabitants of her Comanche village. Together with her small daughter, she was restored to her white relatives, where she afterwards lived in total misery, missing her Comanche husband and her 2 sons. And during her lifetime, she never found out what happened to them. Her uncle admitted once that she was the most unhappy person he had ever met. Now, when Ellen LeMay in 1954 took up the story of Cynthia Ann, he turned one focus from the female captive to the 2 relatives, namely her uncle Amos and her adopted brother Marty, who spent 7 years searching for her. He also lets Marty discover that Amos cares less for his niece, but for his revenge on the Indians, that he is driven by hate and not by the wish to save his niece. And he also introduced an explanation for this obsessive hatred. It turns out that Amos was always in love with his brother's wife Martha, and thus had lost the love of his life. In the LeMay novel, Amos dies before he finds Debbie. He is shot by a young Comanche woman he mistakes for Debbie. Debbie then is finally discovered by Marty, and they return home together. Thus, in the LeMay novel, we have a tragic hero, Amos, who is at heart a good man, but somehow morally damaged by the loss of his love. And he has to end tragically, while Marty, the good man, without any moral damage, succeeds in overcoming the enemy and bringing the woman home. Now, I think the movie is much more interesting with regard to the extent it succeeds in presenting the complexity of the phenomenon of racism. Of course, it would not be fair to accuse a novel of simplification of this topic just because the racism of a person in the plot can be explained in the narrative by a traumatic personal experience and a fatal loss. After all, a novel deals with the particular motives and actions of particular persons, not with general explanations of psychosocial phenomena. Still, a good story always somehow claims to be more than a story about particulars. It is taken to be somehow exemplary, even if the somehow is not clearly defined at all. And therefore, every story which presents a personal explanation of an attitude like racism somehow plants the suggestion that the roots of racism must be sought in traumatic personal experiences like these. Now we finally come to the topic of the negative, the merely possible, and the latent, because I think that the way Ford skips explanations or introduces explanatory gaps into the story is both beautiful and truthful insofar as it helps to recover the historical and normative complexity of the topic of racism. In other words, the topic of racism becomes much more complex in the Ford movie, not because it offers more convincing explanations of the causes of racism, but by means of skipping explanation. For example, Ford adopts from the LeMay novel The Secret Love of Ethan for Martha, but it is introduced in a very different way, in an indirect way. The relationship is shown, never spoken of, never explained. The camera shows Ethan watching Martha in one of the first scenes as she enters the bedroom with his coat. The camera also shows Aaron watching Ethan. The next day, the camera reveals Martha alone in her bedroom, holding the coat of Ethan as if it was something very precious. And then the camera slips to an involuntary observer of the scene, the Reverend Clayton, you see here, whose facial expression slightly changes. He stares forward, an attitude which suggests that he realizes that something is going on he should better not know about, especially after Ethan enters and takes leave from Martha, as you see here. Thus, from the beginning, what is the case, the relationship of brother and sister-in-law, is unfolded in what is not the case, that is a marriage between Martha and Ethan. And this counterfactual possibility is present as an important, if not the most important, emotional factor with regard to Ethan's character and the way Ethan's mind works. It triggers questions which go both back to the past and to the future. Why has Martha married Aaron and not Ethan? Had Ethan left her for too long in the past? And how is this marriage, which has never taken place, related to a marriage which during the search for Debbie is about to take place, a somehow inappropriate marriage plan between Laurie and Charlie, another character? Is this marriage, which is about to take place in the movie, but which later doesn't take place, is this marriage mirroring the marriage between Aaron and Martha? None of these questions can be finally answered, but they make up the imaginative context of the plot. The counterfactual possibility of Ethan and Martha living a happy life instead of what actually happens in the plot is present throughout the movie. And without this negative presence, the miracle of Ethan saving Debbie instead of killing her would have been highly implausible. Still, Ford makes sure that the loss of Martha cannot serve as an explanation for Ethan's racism, because this racism is expressed in a rather ugly way from the very beginning in his remarks to Marty. For this reason, Ford introduces a Marty character into the movie as the offspring of miscegenation. True, by showing a tombstone, Ford gives the audience some faint hints concerning other possible reasons for Ethan's racism, which may go back to the killing of his mother by Comanches. But while this would explain and somehow justify a hatred of the extremely belligerent Comanche, it can hardly serve as an explanation of his despise of all Indians, including the perfectly peaceful tribes. And Ford makes sure that racism cannot be understood merely as a personal reaction to personal experiences by letting other characters, and especially the nice ones, express racist attitudes too. For example, when Marty explains to his beloved Glory, the daughter of the Jorgensen family, that he has to leave again to bring home Debbie, she is enraged and tells him, "Fetch what home?" The leavings of a Comanche buck sold time and again to the highest bidder with savage brats of her own. Do you know what Ethan will do when he has a chance? Put a bullet in her brain. I tell you, Martha would want him to. And even Marty, who never wavers in his resolve to bring back Debbie, behaves very unrespectfully when the Comanche squaw he has married by accident attempts to fulfill her wifely duties, kicking her out of bed and propelling her down a hill. This is a much commented scene which many commentators find unnecessary and interpret it as evidence of a latent racism of Ford himself. But while the scene indeed appears slightly flawed because Marty somehow acts out of character, I think it is not unnecessary because it is supposed to show that even an extraordinary character like Marty, who always seems to be motivated by love, not by hate, can be extremely rude to an Indian. And there's an explanation for this, which is different as from the explanations which appear in the background of Ethan. A cultural misunderstanding brought him in a situation he did not choose, did not wish for, and does not know how to deal with. Now, Ford presents not only various types and routes as possibilities of explanations of racism without letting the viewers decide on any of them. He at the same time shows that racism is somehow illusionary because it is used to be justified by differences. And he shows that these differences are very superficial. The wonderful thing about the movie is that he achieves this without in any ways idealizing the natives. The Comanche are presented as brutal and cruel as they could be. But racism is always justified with differences. And the differences which appear to the settlers to be the difference between belligerent, cruel people who are unable to live by agriculture, depend on raiding other people, the Comanche, while the settlers consider themselves good Christian, family people, peaceful and cultivated people who live by their own efforts at agriculture. On one side, the Ford presents this as quite true. They are, they live by agriculture, they can be peaceful, but on the other side, the peaceful whites are shown to be no less belligerent and cruel as the Comanche. Thus, a preacher is at the same time a commander of the Texas Rangers. The army is raiding and killing women and children. And Ethan even mutilates the dead and takes scalps. Moreover, Ethan and Scar are constructed as mirror images. They are hardly distinguishable with regard to their motives and with regard to what could be expected from them. Thus, the Western story in The Searchers is not about the victory of a good man over a bad man, but about the overcoming of hate and racism by the latency of another life. A latency which derives its power from counterfactual possibilities. I thank you very much for your attention.